Welcome back to the Guardian Film Show, showcasing a crack team of reviewers and more Jeopardy than you can shake a stick at. Hold on to your seats as our intrepid band set forth on a mission to unmask movie frauds and defuse critical bombs. One day, God willing, they shall all receive medals. Coming up imminently, Jason Schwartzman is writing and wronging in the literary drama Listen Up, Philip. Director John Boorman provides a national service with his autobiographical Queen and Country. And Idris Elba considers the inconceivable on the London set drama Second Coming. But we begin with Spy, in which Melissa McCarthy's CIA drone proceeds to grab a hold of the fusty macho espionage drama and then makes it weep, some might say, like a little girl. Ben Lee sat down with the film's director Paul Feig and co-stars Miranda Hart and Jason Statham.
We've intercepted chatter that Rayana Boyanov knows where that nuke is. She knows the identity of all our agents.
We need someone to find the bomb without being detected, but it can't be any of you.
We need someone invisible.
I'll do it.
Okay. Thanks, lunch lady.
I'm serious.
Don't let me down, Cooper.
I will not. I will let you up.
Stop talking.
I will let you up.
Bridesmaids sort of showed people that movies starring a lot of women, funny women, could make money, but then, you know, I think it's easy for a while to go like, well, maybe it was just a fluke. I don't know. It throws me that they're slow on the uptake. I mean, you know, again, it's been proven. Look, Pitch Perfect 2 just made $1 billion. So I just hope we can kind of end the debate and everything and just kind of just have more projects.
I would hate to say that the industry was sexist because that's my sort of big fear about it. So I hope not. I don't know. I think there's a lot of people that aren't thinking and generating the right women for the right characters to front shows like Paul Feig does.
You got this, Susan. You're a warrior. You're a weapon. Hey, there's no sweat.
Looks like you're sweating to me.
Jesus! What are you doing in my room?
Well, how did I get into this shitbox hotel room? Because I'm a real spy.
I thought you quit.
We have to stop the sale of a nuclear bomb. They send in someone who looks like Santa Claus's fucking wife.
Did you forget? I am undercover.
He told me he wanted to make this like a credible action film and he wanted me to be in it. And I said, well, I'm not a comedian. I don't know what I'm going to do. And he said, don't try and be funny. I'm going to leave that to me. So I kind of thought, you know, if you're going to jump in with anybody, you may as well you do it with the people that know what they're doing. And I think he's probably the Scorsese of comedy movies. You know, Paul Feig does it better than anybody. And, you know, the box office kind of shows that. So, in for a penny, in for a pound, yeah.
When I quit teaching and joined the CIA, I thought I was going to be this amazing spy, and I'm still just the same boring person I was.
You play it too safe.
I just hear my mom's voice. Just blend in, let somebody else win. Making a wave isn't always brave.
Brilliant.
Give up on your dreams, Susan. Just to write that in my lunchbox.
I'm joined by Peter Bradshaw and Ben Lee. Peter, this team has given us Bridesmaids, which was funny, and The Heat, which was funny. Please tell me this isn't a case of third time unfunny.
No, I don't think it is. I think it's reasonably funny. I think that unlike, say, Bridesmaids, there isn't a kind of ensemble of ultra-high talent. I think it's Melissa McCarthy who's really got the comedy chops and really not many people who are as good as her. And I think when she's on, delivering a series of very high quality zingers about how stupid other people look, or occasionally she cedes that prerogative to other people and can say how silly she looks, then it's funny.
What do you think I'm gonna do? Run over there and be like, hey, I'm a crazy lady, where's the buffet? I'm from the Midwest, where's Blue Man Group?
Ben, it's not quite a one-woman show though, isn't it? You've got Jason Statham in there who's almost revelatory in doing the kind of comedic version of his usual screen persona.
Yeah, he's a real surprise. He kind of plays a parody of the characters we've seen him play before. I can't think of any comedy I've really seen him in, yet there's always been kind of a comic undercurrent to some of the roles he's done, especially in Crank and kind of the silly transporter stuff. But he really kind of pulls it out of the bag with this. He has this, both him and McCarthy have this really great way of kind of almost improvising or feeling as if they are improvising when they kind of come up with these ridiculous kind of statements or things that he's done or insults she's got for him. And
he's always boasting about his past prowess. He said that he once impersonated Barack Obama.
I think he pulled off his arm came off and then he sewed it back on. And they get increasingly absurd, and I think the film works best when it's at the most absurd, really.
I've swallowed enough microchips and shit them back out again to make a computer.
And I think Paul Feig's very good at kind of allowing his cast members, or at least making us feel as if he's allowing them to kind of like riff on each other for quite a while. And it's that stuff which really works the best. I think the action stuff, a bit like The Heat, feels a bit kind of kids movie-esque at times. I think action comedies, it's tough to really make that kind of side of the plot seem as important.
Yeah.
But I think the film's funny enough for that not to really matter too much.
Also, it's making fun of all of those tropes, isn't it? So then if you're throwing in the sop to that audience, like here is the action, you just think, well, this doesn't quite sit well with the rest of the film.
Yeah, and to be fair, the fight scenes are actually quite accomplished. I think Melissa McCarthy kind of throws herself into it quite well. So I think Rose Byrne's really, really funny in it too. I think Rose Byrne has become a really great comic actress. And she kind of looks like a ridiculous villain, but kind of that's made a joke of too. So it kind of works on that level too.
The moment I saw you standing there in that abortion of a dress, it's as if to say, this is what I've got, world. It's hideous, but it's mine.
I should also say, I think Miranda Hart did well in this, actually. She's not given a huge amount that's very, very funny to do, but she carries off her role very, very plausibly. I have to say, more plausibly than Ricky Gervais ever did in his Hollywood debuts of their various sorts. And she has an extraordinary, surreal pairing with a certain A-list star, which is kind of gobsmacking to those of us who have, you know, got used to kind of cuddly, nice, sweet Miranda Hart on telly. To see her suddenly rocket up to the big league, the super big league like this, is sort of amazing and great, and good luck to her. So I think she does rather well.
Oh, hi, I'm Karen Walker, super spy. Perfect hair, perfect face. She probably cries herself to sleep every night.
I don't. I think
she probably does. And not like sort of cute little tears, like really sort of, you know, silent kind of big.
I don't.
Like a sort of upside down kidney bean. This is what I look like when I'm asleep.
Be quiet.
Do you wonder who we are, just in front of us now?
Hi, hey Nancy, hi Susan.
Hi!
That's the uproarious spy putting the torch to James Bond and his ilk. Happily, however, there is one film still flying the flag for Queen and Country.
Is this the first time you've brought a girl home?
You're so beautiful. Thank you for coming.
Writer-director John Boorman mines his own youth for this sequel of sorts to the wartime drama Hope and Glory. It's now 1952, and the teenage Bill is mired in national service. The empire's fading, change is in the air, and our virgin soldiers hunger for sex, music, and movies.
Ophelia, isn't it?
It can be.
I hope you'll watch the coronation with us.
Oh, sadly, I can't. I'm being picked up in an hour.
Ben, we usually know John Boorman as the kind of great wild-eyed mystic of British cinema, but he's in sort of altogether more gentle, reflective mode here, isn't he?
It's very cosy, it's very pleasant. It kind of feels like it would have worked better maybe as like a sort of three-part Sunday night BBC miniseries. The film actually feels quite episodic too. It's kind of, it's situation after situation, and the tonal shifts to me were quite jarring as a film, whereas I think in a miniseries, the kind of the flip between the silliness of the soldiers kind of messing around on camp and the seriousness of people actually go to war and come back, it would have actually worked better. But it's a really awful word to use, but it's very nice. It's done very pleasantly. It's entertaining in a way, but it feels like it's a difficult film to really sell, which is why this picture and the poster show the brother and sister embracing as if it's a wartime romance. But other than that, it's kind of hard to define, really.
So you live here?
No, just here having a nervous breakdown.
And have you come to save me?
Of course.
It's a film of a man in later life looking back, though, isn't it? So it's very much, I mean, it's a memoir, and we don't really see memoirs dressed up as drama.
I mean, it's. I'm not sure whether this is John Boorman's swan song or not. He's in his 80s now. Only he could have got it made, I think, or could have wanted to make it in some ways. It feels like it could be made at the time about national service. It's as Ben says, it's strange. It's gentle and sweet, and yet it has this undertone of darkness and unhappiness. And I think it's quite good at getting across the idea that national service was sheer bloody hell.
And pointless
and horrible, and reinforced deference to one's superiors in peacetime in a way that a new generation was starting to resent. And all that comes across. I always remember David Lodge's novel about national service called Ginger Your Barmy, when he said that national service felt like a punishment for a crime you can't remember committing. And that really comes across in this film. But how are you going to convince modern audiences, cinema audiences, to care very much about national service? I mean, national service soldiers could and did get sent abroad to kill and die for their country. It wasn't just a matter of square bashing.
Well, there's the threat of Korea looming in the
people
wings.
People really
all the
did
time.
Get sent to Korea in the 50s, in, you know, after World War II. They really did get sent to kill and be killed in Korea. Now, that would, to me, that would have been more interesting to talk about, really, because this is, it's almost like Carry On Sergeant, like the first Carry On film. It's like, you know, Kenneth Connor and Sid James and all these kind of gallery of wacky, wacky people who've really got not much to do except to nurse sort of grudges and resentments and little scams and skives that they've got going on.
We're talking maybe 20 student nurses varying states of undress.
Wow.
Excuse me.
I saw you at the concert.
So you live here?
No, just here having a nervous breakdown.
And have you come to save me?
Of course.
I am going for a swim.
John Boorman's portrait of the artist as a callow young soldier. We now turn our attention to Second Coming, in which Idris Elba and Nadine Marshall play a married couple preparing for an unexpected arrival. And hallelujah, it might just be Jesus.
You've been through what you've been through.
We've been through this before.
Yeah, three times before, four. I know.
Four times. Four times before. You understand?
Idris Elba is Mark, a railway maintenance man who works the tracks outside London and hasn't slept with his wife in months. So how come she's pregnant? And just who is the father? Mark's a contemporary Joseph, and he's in dire need of wise men to come and clean up the mystery.
She's afraid, she's nervous.
And what? I ain't.
Peter, it's good to see Idris Elba in a kind of small-scale, ambitious, character-driven piece like this.
Yeah, I think he's very good. I think the whole thing is very good. I really knew nothing about it. I knew nothing of Debbie Tucker Green's award-winning stage work. Mm. This is my first introduction to her. I like this very much. I thought what's interesting is that the title is the only concession to religion in the entire thing. There are no references to religion in the entire film.
And yet it's all hanging
there. What I think is brilliant about it is that it doesn't feel itself encumbered in any way by that subject. It doesn't feel self-conscious or ironic. Mm. I was reminded that Russell T. Davies' television thing with Christopher Eccleston years ago was much more grandiose on the same subject. Mm. But this is very different. It's a very mysterious fable, which is sort of dressed up as social realism. And it very, very plausibly and persuasively asks you to imagine what would happen to a couple in this state. And, of course, what they would do is they would go into the most tense denial in the most pressure cooker sense. They're going to denial. As the bump gets bigger and bigger, their denial gets more and more intolerable.
And his rage
and
starts
his
kind
rage
of simmering.
Because he's gone into denial and then realised he's going to have to come out of denial. And all the episodic structure of the film is very interestingly managed. And I was really absorbed by this.
I'm going to get crumbs. Ain't you? This is a good bit.
Peter says it's a mysterious fable. Is there a danger that it's too mysterious? It's too kind of elusive and wafty at times?
I think it might be for some people. I think it might frustrate some audiences. But, I mean, it didn't bother me too much because I actually found it, as a family drama, even without any of that stuff going on, I thought it was really entertaining. I thought that the dynamic between the three of them was great. Yeah. I thought, I haven't seen her before, anything Nadine Marshall, and she was fantastic. Yeah. The boy as well is exceptional. And also, it's really great to see a film about a black middle-class family in London that isn't about crime and drugs.
Yeah. Or race, even.
Yeah, so I can't think of the last time I've seen that on the big screen, at least. So that's really great to see. I think at the end, there's nowhere to really go with it, and it's not going to provide any real answers. So it's going to frustrate some audiences, and there's a very cheesy final shot. But as a sort of mood piece in a way, but it's more naturalistic than that as well, so it kind of manages to have that kind of mysterious mood, but also the scenes between the family are all really believable, so I think it kind of works on both ways.
Oh, we're crumbing up the bed.
I knew. It's a good bit.
It's also sort of implicitly just a film about the sort of madness and terror of pregnancy, and particularly kind of late pregnancy, isn't it?
It could very easily be read as that. I think you are subtracting quite a lot of the flavour if you read it solely in that secular sense. But in a way, the secularity is what gives its meta-textual level its tang and its meaning. The only kind of visionary aspect of it are these bad dreams, stroke reveries, stroke hallucinations she has of standing in her bathroom with water starting to drop on her head. And again, that's really interesting marriage, because at the first time you see it, you think, have they got a leak in the bathroom? Because it doesn't look very bizarre at first. Mm. And then Green ramps up the extremity of it. Mm. And interestingly, it's part of what's held against her in her final interview with a psychiatrist. That is what she has to keep quiet about, because that's what's going to have her section if she doesn't keep very stum about these visions. And I thought, again, it was really interestingly managed.
Do you still think you're giving birth to the second coming? Chucky. Chucky.
The star of Bethlehem swings over South London, possibly in Second Coming. In the meantime, we're swinging towards our final film of the week. It's called Listen Up, Philip, and it stars Jason Schwartzman as a hot-tempered, self-obsessed writer, brilliant on the page, utterly insufferable in person, a bit like Peter. Anyway, let's take a look.
Is that the new book?
Yeah, things are gonna be pretty crazy for me after the release. Los Angeles in January, San Francisco, and the whole West Coast thing, really. I'm told to expect big things out there.
You sound like you're bragging.
That's because I am bragging.
Philip Lewis Friedman is a literary lion at large in New York. He's young, gifted, and lauded, but it's not enough. It's never enough. And so he takes off for the country to rediscover his muse. How will his nearest and dearest manage now that the great writer has gone?
I feel him weighing on me more in his absence than I did when he was around.
Where is he?
He's just gone.
You are selfish and unsentimental.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
On the contrary.
Ben, it strikes me he's not the most likable character. Is that a problem for you?
Initially, no. I think I'm really sort of impressed when writers are daring enough to create a central character who is as deeply unlikable as him. He kind of reminds me of sort of Noah Baumbach's characters, a bit like Ben Stiller in Greenberg and Jeff Daniels in Squid in the Whale and Nicole Kidman in Margot at the Wedding. And for the first 30 or 40 minutes, I was really kind of fascinated by how deeply unlikable he was. I mean, he's such a prick, and they're so unafraid of sort of how awful he is. There's no attempt to soften him. But after a while, that kind of his character becomes kind of boorish. In a way that maybe is deliberate, but I think it becomes a character who doesn't really have much to do other than just be awful. And so it kind of wears on you a bit, not because he's so awful, but because there's not really much to him. Whereas
also the film was kind of almost wrong-footed me, because I thought it was setting up as a kind of comedy, like this absolute kind of satirical assault on this person. And then it kind of goes in different directions, doesn't it? For better and worse, I guess.
He kind of meanders a bit when they leave New York. I think there's a great sort of repartee between him and Jonathan Pryce for a while. But I think that kind of, again, does become a bit boorish too, because they're both equally boorish people. And whereas it veers off for a while and explores what happens to his girlfriend, played by Elizabeth Moss, and that's almost more interesting after a while. You kind of want to see more of her.
It's an unorthodox structure, isn't it? I'm not sure whether it's kind of bold or misconceived.
I wavered, but I came down on the side of bold in the end. I really like the freewheeling aspect of it. It had a kind of, if this doesn't sound too pretentious, such a Cassavetes after a while, in that it doesn't stick to act structures. Mm. You're never sure about what it's supposed to be centrally about, despite the fact you are set up to think it's just about him, but it's not really about him. And it whooshes around the scene where he and Ike pick up these two women and they have this excruciating kind of late night party when he's got to come round, and the whole thing collapses when the daughter shows up.
Will you admit that you made a mistake?
I don't think that's necessary. It was a simple misunderstanding.
Could happen to anyone.
Was anybody speaking to you?
I thought I was part of the conversation.
Well, you weren't supposed to be. In fact, you're not even supposed to be here.
I found myself really absorbed by the fact that the movie just sort of whooshes around, it improvs it, it kind of goes in various directions. Mm. It doesn't say, here's act one, here's act two, here's the obstacle, we're going to surmount it, here are the life lessons, we've learned it, credits, which is what almost every film you see is. I'm fascinated by Jason Schwartzman when he insists on gloating over all the people he knew before he was famous and summons them for meetings just to rub their noses in it.
I was going to give you a sign copy of my book, but now I'm not.
I was just gripped by it, especially when he was saying to his college contemporary, you know, what happened to you, man? What happened to you? Pretending to be appalled, when of course he's delighted that his college contemporary has failed. What would appall him is if his college contemporary was successful. That would enrage him. Mm. And so I think it's very interesting about a kind of male desire to conceive of success as a kind of revenge on people who don't know they've done anything wrong.
Wish somebody here would say something mean.
Mean?
Or honest. It's unlikely that everybody here has nothing but praise. It's not real. I don't like how this is starting.
These are decent people.
They just want to be your friend.
I know, that's the problem.
Sorry to bother you again. Is there trash in here?
Yes, I'm right here.
It's jittery, it's jaundiced, it's listen up, Philip. Time now for your questions. Peter, do you have any film posters on the wall at your house?
Yes, I do. I have to say, I do. This sounds very, very insufferable, but I have a framed poster of In the Mood for Love, which is signed by Wong Kar-wai, Tony Leung and Maggie Cheung. And that, I know, is appalling, and I should be taken out and shot for saying that, but I am rather proud of it because it is it's a favourite film of mine, and I think it is interesting to have them signed by all three of them.
Ben?
I sound like a bit of a wanker, but I have a Polish version of the Fatal Attraction poster on my wall as well, just to be like a real Guardian journalist. It's when obviously Polish posters didn't have to kind of conform by any rules, so they had to get an artist to design a poster rather than have sort of any strict faces being or names being mentioned. So it's a snake eating an apple, kind of turned in a loop. It's pretty.
What's the film that you have laughed at the most?
For me, I laugh at a lot of films. I laugh at a lot of comedies all the time. If I'm honest...
You do, and I've heard you. I do. Nobody else is.
Nobody else is. It's a difficult one. I mean, I remember laughing uproariously and feeling that I had to justify it in my review of The Other Guys, which I'm not backing down. But probably for sheer absurd laughing all the way through, I don't think I've ever matched my response when I was a teenager to Kentucky Fried Movie. Laughing with a sense of guilt and pleasure and also defiance at all my elders and betters who told me never to watch this film and that I would virtually, my soul would be in a terrible, immortal perdition if I did.
Ben, what do you reckon?
It kind of changes with age, really. I think when I was younger, the film that made me laugh the most was The War of the Roses. My parents were divorced at a young age. Maybe I was like a bit of a fuck-up.
Yeah, sort of a form of therapy.
Yeah, maybe. My parents used to hate me watching it, I think, because they thought that's what divorce was like. But
yeah, when I was a kid, you put Kramer versus Kramer
yeah,
and laughed at
hilarious,
that.
Yeah. Ah, divorce. I'm not crying. So that was the film as a kid. And then I think as a teenager, I think the South Park movie, as puerile as it is, it's the first time I saw it, I laughed. Same with Team America as well. That's still a hilarious film.
Team America.
And then more recently, the past few years, I did laugh consistently pretty much through Bridesmaids as well. Again, I think those are quite relative to my age at the time, I guess.
And sad to say, we are now out of time, which inevitably means that the laughter stops here. My thanks to Peter and to Ben. Thanks to you for watching. Please join us next week for more galumphing comedy pratfalls at what critics are calling the Guardian Film Show.